Welcome to Earl Thomas Podcast. Today we're going to do an introduction to value. I see this as a struggle with a lot of wholesalers. And now that we've covered, you know, kind of some of the basics of how to enter the business, it's important to know how to value properties when you go look at them so that you can negotiate with the sellers and with the buyers. As a disclaimer, I actually used to get paid to value properties. I was an appraiser before I started investing, so I'm going to kind of walk you through some of the simple things of valuing houses so that you'll get a better understanding of it, because it's not hard if you break it down into the most simple of terms. So with that, let's get started with it. The first thing that you want to look at is what I always call is the principle of substitution. And it's a principle that's in real estate, economics, just about everything in life. One analogy I always use is you always buy what's on sale. That's something that we all do in our everyday lives. So when you go and look at houses, it's no different. What can you get that's the best deal? What's on sale? So when you're going out there and, you know, you've got a $150,000 house and the seller is wanting $140,000 for it, but, you know, down the street, you've got somebody else that'll sell it to you for $120,000. Now, that may be a deal, it may not, but you have to come to the conclusion of is $30,000 in equity, you know, can you get that sold? What's the best deal on that? If you look at things in a rational term, let's say that you go to Walmart, there's an item there that's $5, but the exact same item is at Target for $10. You're gonna buy what's on sale for $5. You're gonna save that $5. So everything in real estate is the exact same way. That's what makes things deals. So when you go and look at it, you know, I don't know if a lot of you ever played Monopoly when you were growing up, but let's just say that, you know, you had all four utilities and you had some hotels on them, things like that. So you were getting, you know, max rent, max revenue coming in, but then you had an opportunity to exchange it for Boardwalk and, you know, start building that. Now, is that a good deal? If you ask me, I would say no. Because you've got four chances to make money versus two with having Boardwalk if you have the other. And I can't remember off the top of my head what the other one is, but you have to go through the negotiation process of realizing what's actually a deal and what's not. So when you go and you look at things that are happening, you know, in your market, you're looking for what's the best deal, what gives you the best opportunity. So that's where the comparison part of it comes in. And one big thing that I see people doing that is not correct is you're comparing in reverse. You try to take your house and turn it into the house that you're comparing. That's not how it's done. You take the house that you're comparing and you turn it into your house. So let's say that you have a fully renovated house down the street that's a $150,000 house. The house that you're looking at, you think needs $25,000 worth of work. But you also have that, what I call is a headache to be able to do the work to get it to that point of the $150,000 house down the street that is fully renovated. So when you do that, you have to actually subtract what is going on as far as renovation, the cost of it, the time, the risk, the carrying cost, those kind of things. So when you go in, you know your starting point just off of the renovation is going to be $125,000 to get you to that $150,000 completely renovated sales price. So in order for you to make money, now you have to subtract what money you want to make if you want a 20% return. Well, now you've got to actually subtract, you know, $30,000 off of $150,000, you know, sales price. So now you're at 95 is what you're expecting to be able to get that property under contract for. If you can't get it for that, sometimes, you know, you go for the 20% return, 10% return, whatever is in your market and what gets things sold. So you back into it instead of move forward into it. You don't take the house that you're looking at and turn it into the house that you're comparing it to. Now, to get to that price, in a lot of ways, you are turning it into that house, but for comparison purposes, to come to the value of it, is you take, if the $150,000 house has hardwoods, your house has carpet. Well, the comparison house is going to get a negative adjustment because hardwoods are more desirable in a lot of areas than a house is with carpet all through it. So in order to basically turn your house into the house down the street, you have to take the carpet up and now turn it, put the hardwood down to get to that value. But in order to compare it, you back out of it to take the hardwoods off. And what would it sell for if it had carpet just like your house? So it can be confusing when you just get started, but if you get in the habit of saying, okay, this house that I'm comparing it to, what would it sell for if I turned it into the house that I'm looking at? That's when you are able to come up with a more accurate value, offer, you know, purchase price, so that you can make the best deals and actually get things sold. One thing that I always try to relate to people to help them understand it as well is another analogy. And since I'm a guy, my analogy usually goes towards, you know, women. But, you know, for women, if you look at a man that, you know, is not kept, he doesn't shave his face, doesn't cut his hair, you know, isn't dressed nice, those kind of things, well, he's not going to get a second look, and you're going to have a negative opinion about him. The same is true for men when they look at women. If a woman is not kept, you know, she could be the best person in the world, but is she going to get a second look and get asked out for that date? So with the analogy, when you look at houses, if a house is in poor condition, can you make it look better? Can you, you know, do a, like an extreme makeover for that house to be able to get it to the point to where it will sell, it'll get that second look? And a lot of times, will it get the first look? Because you don't necessarily want someone taking a second look at it. You want them to bite on it, you know, as soon as they see it. So when you're going through and you're looking at these things, what I always call is a plain Jane house typically doesn't get a second look, and I won't go anywhere near them. And what I call is a plain Jane house is just one of those square boxes that's got that front little stoop on it. You know, whether that's a two-story, one-story, whatnot, it just doesn't have a lot of appeal to it. So in order to overcome that, do you put a long front porch on it? How are you dressing up the front of that house to keep it away from looking at a like a plain Jane? So what I always look for is what is actually going to sell, because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter where you are. The women are the ones writing the checks, because they're the ones that are looking, you know, is this safe for my kids to be around? Do I like it? Those kind of things. Can I imagine raising my family in this? So when it comes to either writing a check for the mortgage or for the rent, the women are having the final say. Men go in and just kind of shake their head, happy wife, happy life. And that's how it is. So when you go and you're looking at houses, and in a lot of ways, you need to look at it through the lenses of a woman, because if you can't get them in the front door and it doesn't look appealing to a woman, the odds are that it's either not going to sell for the maximum amount or it's not going to rent for the maximum amount. Because when you fail in real estate, you fail by two things. You fail by price and you fail by appeal, because if it's overpriced, it's never going to sell. And if you can't get somebody through the front door, it's never going to sell or it's never going to rent. And if it does, then the price and the will always correct itself, because you're either going to have to lower the sales price or you're going to have to lower the rent on it to be able to get it sold or get it rented. So when you go out and you're looking at these properties, you need to take the approach of, what can I do to make this the best? Do I go and put on a, you know, a fine dining dress? Do I put on a jacket, coat, tie, you know, a full-blown suit? Do I shave? Do I get my hair cut? You know, what can you do in that aspect of comparison to be able to get the max value, whether it's a sales price or a rent, out of that property? And that's kind of a subjective thing, because when you go across the country, there are different styles of houses. So, you know, say out west, they use a lot of stucco. You know, in the north and the south, they'll use a lot of brick, vinyl siding, things like that. A lot of it is due to climate. A lot of it is due to what people are used to looking at. So you have to take that in your own market and figure out what is going to be the best in those markets and go from that point on. Something that's gonna, there are three things that are gonna really determine if you're on the right track. So when you're going out and you're looking at these houses, you need to analyze the demand for the property, for the area. You need to look at the utility of the property, and you need to look at the scarcity of the property. So everybody really knows what demand is. Right now we're in a high demand market because the supply is low, so prices are going up, or they're staying stable depending on where you are. When you think of utility, what that means is how can that property be used? Does it have two bedrooms, three bedrooms? Does it have a yard? Does it have a fence? Does it have a shed in the back for some storage? Can you keep your lawnmower back there? What's the utility? What's the use available for that property? When you talk about scarcity, you're looking at partial utility of it, but scarcity more involves, you know, how many three bedrooms are available, how many properties are available with a larger lot, how many have a backyard versus a front yard, those kind of things. So when you start, you know, looking at your value, you need to look at those three things and determine, you know, is this the point where I push the value of it, because the demand is high, the utility is high, and the scarcity is also high. If all three of those things are high, it may lead you to make a higher offer. But if two of the three are low, or one of the three are low, then you need to go more on the low end of what, you know, the value would be, what you would offer, things like that. What I always look at is, you know, a lot of people say, what can I do to add value to a house? Do I renovate the kitchen, put a new roof on, change it from carpet to hardwood, paint the house, things like that? There are certain things that will add value to a house, but you need to really understand what those things are. Kitchen, 9 times out of 10, will add value to the house. Adding another bedroom does not always offer more value to a house, because you can do what they call as over improve. So if, you know, the standard is 3 bedroom and now you've got a 4 bedroom, are you going to get the most per foot out of that? Because that 4th bedroom, there may not be a lot of demand for that. So you've got to go and you've got to understand your market for what's the demand for a 4 bedroom. Yes, there's more utility for a 4 bedroom because there's more to be used. How many 4 bedroom scarcity are available for sale or for rent? So the bigger picture of it, remember that you've got the demand, the utility, and the scarcity, and it needs to be high on all three of those if you're ever going to push the value or your offer. If all three are not high, it's not a good idea to push it. When you're looking at it, it falls into utility a lot, but it it's not just utility because it falls in with demand and scarcity too, but a lot of times when people talk about it, it makes more sense to use utility with it, but it's something called the highest and best use. So what you have with the highest and best use, you have four different tests. Is it legally permissible, which basically means zoning, approval, code, those kind of things. Is it, can you legally use the property for what you want to use it for? The other one, another one is it maximally productive? Does it make the most money? So to think about this, when you go into areas that are predominantly rental versus predominantly owner-occupied resale properties with an agent, MLS, whatnot, which one of those is going to make you the most money? Typically, in owner-occupied areas, doing a traditional flip is going to make you the most money. Traditionally, in rental areas, your sales prices are going to be a little bit lower because the demand is for rental. You make more money short-term and long-term by renting the property. The other is financially feasible. Does it make financial sense to buy, to renovate, to keep whatever property that you're looking at? If it doesn't make sense on it, then it's not going to pass that test. And we'll talk about the financial feasibility in just a little while. The last test is it physically possible? Now, in today's world, you can pretty well build a house on the side of a hill, side of a mountain, and you know it'll last. But do you want to? Is it, you know, physically possible? I would think you can't necessarily build a house in the middle of a swamp. I mean, you could, but would you want to really? So physically possible just kind of looks at those aspects of would you really want to? How much elbow grease are you going to need to be able to do it? So if it doesn't pass all four of these tests, then you're not going to pass the highest and best use analysis of it. So whatever you're trying to do with that property is going to cost you money, because if you're trying to sell a rental house as a traditional flip, you're not going to make as much money. If you're trying to sell a traditional flip as a rental house, you're not going to make as much money on your sales price. So you have to look at all four of these tests as one, and whenever it passes all four of these tests is when you're going to make the most money, and whoever you're selling it to is going to make the most money. But it's how you structure those deals that you're doing of whether or not you and your buyer are going to make the most money out of it. So legally permissible, maximally productive, physically possible, and financially feasible. You pass those tests, you'll have the most money on the table, you know, to do it. So to go back to that financially feasible aspect of it, there's something that's called obsolescence. There are three types of obsolescence: physical, functional, and economic. And really what obsolescence is just a fancy word for wrong. There's something wrong with either the property, the area, you name it, but there's something wrong with that scenario. So the physical part of it is kind of easy to understand. What's physically wrong? This could be condition. So if you need to, you know, if your house is in need of renovation, then there is physical obsolescence associated with that house. That's just common and it's easy to understand. The functional part, functional obsolescence, is a little bit harder to understand. So a couple of different examples. Let's say that you have a house that was built in 1940. One room in this house doesn't have a closet in it. Do you count that as a bedroom? You can and you can't. The answer is a 50-50. If it's in an area in the house where, you know, it's away from a main room, like a living room, kitchen, things like that, but it doesn't have a closet, when that house was built, by the era of that house, it was used as a bedroom. Because years ago, they used to put closets in the hallways. Closets were not actually in bedrooms in the 1940s. So technically, that's a bedroom because that's how it was built. By today's standards, what you need to do is build a closet in that room to be able to legally count it as a bedroom. But when that house was built, it was built to be used as a bedroom. Another example, let's say that you've got a second level, or you've got, you know, that same room that we were just talking about that doesn't have a closet in it. But just off of that closet, I mean, just off of that room that doesn't have a closet, there's another door that leads to a room that does have a bed, that does have a closet. So we're calling that a bedroom. In order to get around that functional obsolescence, you need another entry, and you need to close that entry to that back bedroom off, because functionally, having to walk through one bedroom to get to another bedroom is wrong. You don't, that's not considered right by any means, regardless of, you know, when the house was built. If you have to walk through a bedroom to go upstairs to get to a second level, or go downstairs to get to a bedroom, that's functionally wrong, because it's a private room now made public. So the functional part of that house is, it has to flow. If it doesn't, if it just seems off, then that's functional obsolescence. Now, when you go in years ago, there's a requirement in Fannie Mae that you're supposed to actually walk into a house and there be a foyer as soon as you walk through the front door. You're not supposed to walk through a house straight into a main public room. That would be considered functional obsolescence, as Fannie Mae, you know, wrote it years ago, and it hasn't actually been changed. It's still on the books. Another thing that, you know, a lot of you probably don't even realize, when you go in these garden home neighborhoods where they're just built right on top of each other, and you see these small little trees in the front yard, you're wondering why they put these little bitty trees in the front yard. A Fannie Mae requirement is that there is a shade tree in the front yard. So builders get around this requirement because they technically put a shade tree in the front yard. It's not a shade tree as soon as it's built because it's small, but it will grow into one. So whenever you go and you look in these little garden home communities and you see these small little trees in the front yard, that's the Fannie Mae requirement of a shade tree. It's just not actually providing any shade yet. It'll take it, you know, 20, 30 years to grow to be able to provide the shade that that the house is supposed to have. The last thing I want to cover in this introduction is know what you're comparing. A lot of people struggle with this. You don't go out and compare a three-bedroom house to a two-bedroom house. Now, you can use it as support. You can use a four-bedroom as support. But you want to compare apples to apples. When you go out and you start saying, okay, I've got a one level, but I'm going to start appraising it, you know, with a two level with a basement. That's not the same house. That's not the same utility. The demand is going to be different for it because some people don't want to go upstairs. Some people don't care. If you go and you look at houses with pools or you know, things like that, that's offering extra utility, but it's also adding cost to it for the maintenance and the upkeep of it. So when you're going and you're trying to figure out the value of it, if, like I said, if you have a single level, three bedroom, two bath, 1,500 square feet, you need to go and find as many three bedroom, two bath, 15 or close to 1,500 square feet houses that you possibly can. Now, if you have to, an easier way to do things, instead of going out in distance, is going back in time a little bit. Because let's say that you have a house right now that's, you know, identical if it was renovated. It sold for $175,000, but you go to a neighborhood that's 2 miles away and you see a house over there for $150,000 or $200,000, whichever side of it that, you know, it's going to be on. Instead of going to that different neighborhood, let's go back in time to maybe 8 months ago, a year ago, sometimes even 2 years ago. Because now, let's say that you've got that one sale that's $175,000, but a year ago, you had pretty much the exact same house that sold for $150,000. Okay, so now I can see that I have a $25,000 adjustment to the positive based on time. So what that means is you know, the market, the prices are going up. So my time adjustment will show me better in that exact same neighborhood of what's going on. So if you have the $175,000 house, let's say you have another house that's just lower in condition, just a little bit, but it sold for $165,000. Now you have that house that was sitting over there a year ago that was $150,000. So instead of saying, okay, well, I've got a $175,000 house because that's the top sales price, take it to $170,000, because you're never going to go to the very top of the range. Anytime you go to the top of the range, you're asking for trouble. You go and you look at a range of sales prices, and you always try to stick it in the middle somewhere. So $165,000, you know, and $175,000 sale that's current, you know, you may just, something may be a little bit different with your house. So you say, okay, instead of $170,000, I'm going to say $168,000, because there's going to be a negative reaction to whatever that is associated with your house. Or you may say, there's something about my house that's better than the $165,000 house, so I'm going to say $172,000, because you have to have, whenever you go and sell these, you're not going to have an appraiser or a buyer that's going to say, oh, I'm going to pay you for, you know, the top sales price in the area, because you only have one. You don't have, you know, five houses that sold for $175,000. You only have one. There was a reason that house sold for $175,000. The value may be going up, as you can see with the time. You went from $150,000, you've got $165,000 and $175,000 now, but you have to have supporting evidence that's current to say, okay, well, now my house is worth $175,000, $180,000. If your buyer wants to push it to that and try it, that's up to them. But when you're trying to sell these deals, you never, ever, ever push it to the max range, because a buyer likely is not going to get that when they try to sell it. So whenever you're trying to pass that off on them, they're going to think in the back of their mind, and they're going to start hitting your deals on them. Well, they push it to the top every single time. They don't leave any what if room for me whenever I'm, you know, looking at these houses. So if you sit there and you send your buyer, hey, I had this house a year ago that sold for $150,000. Here more currently, I've got $165,000, $175,000. So what it shows me right now is there is at least a $15,000 appreciation that's going on in this current neighborhood, this current market. But I believe that, you know, it's a $170,000 house, because of the $15,000 would be the $165,000 and the $150,000. You say, I believe, you know, you've got a $170,000 house because that's in the middle of the range. And your buyers are going to take you a little more serious, because they can say, okay, well, that's fair. I don't have any problem with that, because every single person that's out there is going to pretty well think the same thing. Now, your buyers always want to save money, so they're more likely to go back down to your 165 than your 170. But the way that you phrase it in that, hey, I've got at least a $15,000 appreciation over the past year, so this is an unarguable ARV. If you say 170, that's an opinion, and you have to let your buyers have that opinion. But at the same time, now when you've said, I've got that at least $15,000 appreciation, that's a fact. That can't be argued. When you try to push that extra five on it, that's when you can get into some trouble to say, my opinion is different than yours, but the opinion that wins is the opinion with the person with the money to buy it from you. So you have to go through and support it with a fact then let somebody make up their own mind, have their own opinion about it. And if you do it in that way, then now you're actually going to benefit, because they're going to take you a little bit more serious, and they're going to think, well, they actually know what they're doing, and they're not trying to get, you know, maximum amount of money out of me every single time to be able to do this. So in kind of summary, closing, whenever you're looking at these properties, you have to make sure you are comparing the same thing, as close to the same thing as you can possibly get. You don't overstate the value. You go back and you do your research on it, because one of the easiest ways to figure things out is going through and looking at houses, taking their square footage and dividing it by their sales price, so you can get a price per foot. If you're comparing single level houses, you're gonna get an accurate amount on that square footage of what it is selling for today. So you're not gonna have to go to another neighborhood. You're gonna be able to break it down right then and there, because you're gonna see the things that are causing the difference in sales price. So if you've got one that sold for $110 a square foot, and you've got another one that sold for $120 a square foot, when you see these pictures of these houses that have sold, it's going to make sense to you of where that $10 difference in the price came from. It may be a big backyard, or it may be the hardwood versus the carpet. But if you go through and you see one now that's down the street that sold for $80 a square foot, but it's similar in size, same type property, those kind of things, now you know you've got either a condition issue, or you've got something that is wrong around that house. And that's going to lead you to kind of investigate further, or either say, I can't use that, whatever you want to do with it. But when you break it down on a price per foot, you're going to start seeing these things. If you're comparing the exact same thing, or as close to the exact same thing of what you're dealing with, breaking it down by the per foot basis is going to show you what's going on with the comparable sales and help you get to that value. So if everything, you know, going back to the $165,000 house and the $175,000 house, you're going to see, okay, the $165,000 sold for $110 a square foot, the $175,000 one sold for $120 a square foot. Where is that $10? And it really may just be as simple as the $175,000 house had a bigger backyard. It may be that simple. It may not. But it gives you a smaller number to work with to kind of break it down to be able to understand what the difference is and what caused that price. If you follow this, you'll get to the point to where you're going to understand value a little bit more. Just remember, you're looking at apples and apples versus apples and oranges, because if you do that, you're going to stay confused. You're not going to get the value right, and it's going to cause you problems down the road. So we started today with just the introduction, some basic principles of things to do. We're going to continue to do this on a progressive basis to kind of, we're just starting with the foundation today, but we're going to get more in depth of, you know, things to come, whether it be detrimental effects to property, adverse possession. We're going to get into these type things to where people have a better understanding. You know, that I see it all the time. People say, well, I don't have any comps around. Eventually we'll get to the extraction method so that you understand how to do that, so that you can actually start preparing your deals a little bit better from start to finish with your offers, with your sellers, to, you know, selling it to your buyers. But we had to start with the foundation so that you get a better understanding of where you're headed, so that you can start putting together these deals, you know, to get them sold. But with that, I appreciate you listening again. If you've got, you know, any questions, feel free to make a, you know, comment, ask questions. If you want some more information on it, you can visit earltoms.com, and there'll be things on the site to help you build the business in general. And with that, I'll bring it to a close, and we'll see you again next week. Thanks for listening.